The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to this Friday edition of The Dan Proft Show. It's been an eventful week, and finally, we got a press briefing from the Trump legal team yesterday afternoon, of course, and it was important. And I think I don't want to say it was overdue, because I think it takes a long time to call together as much information as they're trying to call together when you're filing lawsuits in half a dozen states. So I grant them the time to do that so they can present something intelligent for public consumption, which I believe they largely did, both Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. The principles, it would seem to me, of Trump's legal team covering different aspects of the cases that are being filed and the arguments that are being advanced, the theories behind them and the evidentiary support for them. But it's good because, as I've said from the outset of this, from election night forward, you want to do voter outcome challenges, make fraud accusations. You need to bring the public along with your legal arguments. It is litigating this in the court of public opinion, as well as obviously in courts of law. And again, Giuliani and Sidney Powell are experienced prosecutors. I'm inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt when they suggest they have the goods. Giuliani in particular presented some evidentiary support in the form of affidavits for some of the assertions that he made. And Sidney Powell less so on the evidentiary front, but she's got a more complicated issue she is trying to explicate when it comes to fraud, obviously with respect to the actual election, the infrastructure, the voting machines, as well as the software. So let's just begin with the major claims that were made based on what they think they have or will soon be in possession of. Rudy started with this, the assertion of how widespread it is.
Because there's not a singular voter fraud in one state. This pattern repeats itself in a number of states, almost exactly the same pattern, which to any experienced investigator, prosecutor, would suggest that there was a plan from a centralized place to execute these various acts of voter fraud, specifically focused on big cities and specifically focused on, as you would imagine, big cities controlled by Democrats, and particularly focused on big cities that have a long history of corruption.
Mm-hmm. And the ultimate claim?
In the states that we have indicated in red, Georgia, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Arizona, we more than double the number of votes needed to overturn the election in terms of provable illegal ballots.
More than double. That's a big claim to suggest that you have more than double the illegal votes that you need to overturn the election. So to reverse the outcomes in at least three of the states that he mentioned that were on the board, as it were, just because it's top of mind with the hand recount being completed in Georgia. I thought it was it's worth noting what Rudy had to say about Georgia. They're not done litigating in Georgia just because of the hand recount, because, of course, all the hand recount did, and the only purpose of it wasn't a full canvas, was to see if the hand count matched up with the machine count. But it doesn't address the underlying issue of counting legal ballots. And so Giuliani on the topic.
Georgia, we're about to file a major lawsuit in Georgia. That'll be filed probably tomorrow. I don't need to go through it. Virtually the same things I've told you before. In the city of Atlanta, Republicans were not allowed to watch the absentee mail-in ballot process. Inspections completely cast aside. And we have numerous double voters. We have numerous out-of-state voters. And we have specific evidence of intimidation and changes of vote.
David Schaefer, the head of the Republican Party in Georgia, he tweeted out yesterday afternoon, "More election news never reported. Two Fulton County Elections Board members voted against certifying the Fulton County election returns because signatures on absentee ballots were not electronically verified. Because of the massive increase in absentee ballots, Fulton County purchased software to electronically verify signatures, but could not get it to work. It reverted to all manual signature verification." And the question is, did they execute the manual signature verification when it came to those absentee ballots in lieu of the electronic system not working? You know, these are some of the underlying issues that you're seeing play themselves out in many of these jurisdictions. You had just on counts, for example, another reversal yesterday in Wayne County, Michigan, where those Republicans that were sort of cowered into on the election commission there, cowered into certifying the Wayne County, Michigan results, despite the disparity between the counts in what, 71% of the precincts, on the promise that the Secretary of State would audit those results. They rescinded their certification because it became clear to them that the Secretary of State was not serious about auditing those results. And part of this is to maybe take a step back here, because there's so many jurisdictions and there's so many buckets of fraud allegations, if you will. So just trying to parse them a little bit. There's poll watchers. The idea that poll watchers were not allowed to watch the count, and a ridiculous decision in Pennsylvania by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, which we'll talk about next hour with Greg Tufel, who's a lawyer in Pennsylvania, suggesting that there's, you know, no right to stand within a certain distance to the actual count going on. Well, of course, that makes no sense. Why would you have an election provision, statutory, that allows poll watchers to watch the count, which is universal, but say it's okay to keep them at a distance where they can't watch the count? This sort of violates the spirited and legislative intent of the law. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has made some real doozies of decisions, but I don't, even with that, and it obviously this happened elsewhere too, it's alleged in their affidavits to that effect, which Rudy Giuliani went through in part. But I don't see much upside to that, because despite what Giuliani said, and despite what very well may be true, I certainly believe those, there was every indication that these election officials were not being too accommodating to poll watchers to watch the count. What is the remedy? To discount, set aside all the votes that were counted when there were no poll watchers present, or at least within distance of sight? A court is just going to be highly, highly resistant to do that. Sans some evidence that when the poll watchers were out of view of the count, there was material fraud that was committed. Not just the potential, it was vulnerable to fraud, but actual proof that fraud occurred. So that's one bucket. The lack of inspection of absentee ballots in terms of signature match, for example, that's another bucket. The backdating of ballots. Officials being directed to say a ballot we received on November 4th was actually received on November 2nd. And here's an example where Rudy Giuliani actually presented an affidavit, which is evidence. He's right to say that of what had occurred. This is Rudy Giuliani introducing the public to Jesse Jacob, just by in the form of an affidavit, in a city worker in Detroit.
"Because I know you keep reporting falsely that we have no evidence, that we have no specific acts of fraud. That's because the coverage of this has been almost as dishonest as the scheme itself. The American people are entitled to know this. You don't have a right to keep it from them. You don't have a right to lie about it. And you are. I mean, you don't report to them that a citizen of this country, a very fine woman, who is willing to allow me to give you her name, I can't give you all these affidavits, because if I do, these people will be harassed. They'll be threatened. They may lose their job. They will lose their friends. We've lost lawyers in this case because they've been threatened. We've had lawyers that need protection. What's going on in this country is horrible. And the censorship that you're imposing is making it worse.
And now to Jesse Jacob.
I was instructed not to look at any of the signatures on the absentee ballots. If she was instructed to look, not to look for any of the signatures on the absentee ballots, why the heck do you sign it in the first place? In order to identify it. She was instructed not to do that because many of the absentee ballots were fraudulent, and they knew that.
And when we come back, I want to go through some of the remaining buckets of voter fraud allegations and some concrete examples of fraud that were described by Giuliani and supported by affidavits. We'll do that right after this. There's too many men, too many people, making too many problems, and not much left to go around. Can't you see this is a land of confusion? This is the Dan Proft Show. Welcome back to the show. Picking up our discussion of the nine buckets of voter fraud allegations, as I'm describing them, we've gotten through three. Poll watchers, no inspection of absentee ballots like signature check, the backdating of ballots, and the Giuliani example of Jesse Jacob, a woman who did provide an affidavit and is allowing her name to be publicly disseminated, who told Giuliani and testified to this under threat of perjury, that she was instructed, as were other workers in Detroit, by supervisors to backdate mail-in ballots. Giuliani, or I should say, another bucket, curing ballots. This is relevant in Pennsylvania at minimum. And this is where some election authorities were allowing individuals to correct a ballot that would have otherwise been invalidated because it was incorrectly filled out. And in other jurisdictions, not the case, because there's no provision in Pennsylvania state law to cure this ballot, these ballots. And so he gives an example of this that we'll pick up. Well, let's hear from Giuliani with the example of this just to make it concrete.
One of our plaintiffs, Mr. Henry, cast a absentee ballot and he failed to put it in the secure envelope inside. He just put it in open, naked. That ballot was cast aside because it was invalid, because that breaks the privacy of the vote. In Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, if they noticed that there wasn't an inner envelope, they'd contact the voter and allow him to vote again. Or if he didn't fill it out completely, or if he made a mistake and didn't sign his full name, he was allowed to cure it. There is no such provision under the law of Pennsylvania. The Democrat Secretary of State made that up.
Right. And so we'll talk about this, as I mentioned before, with Greg Tufels, an attorney in Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh, actually next hour, for some of the details there. But you get it. That creates a two-tiered system of election administration. This is similar in substance to the issue in Bush v. Gore in 2000. In some counties in Florida, they were counting hanging chads one way. In other counties, they were counting them another way. That was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. And the court, supermajority of the court, agreed that it was a violation. And then a narrow majority agreed on the cure, the remedy for that that disparate treatment. But this is a legitimate issue, this curing of ballots. It's a legitimate equal protection constitutional issue. The question, of course, is we don't have a handle, at least that I'm aware of just how many of those cured ballots, just how many ballots were cured and then counted. We don't know. And it's been seemingly difficult to get numbers with some of these categories of ballots out of Pennsylvania. All right. So there's number four. Poll watchers, inspection of absentee ballots, backdating ballots, curing ballots. the indefinitely confined. This is particular to Wisconsin, where the indefinitely confined do not have to present ID in order to obtain and cast obtain a ballot and cast a vote. Normally, this is a relatively small cohort of the overall electorate. But because of the expanded definition to include anybody indefinitely confined because of COVID-related restrictions, it was exponentially more indefinitely confined that did an end run around the voter ID requirement in Wisconsin. And Giuliani talked a little bit about Wisconsin, too, and the issues there as the recount in those two counties, Milwaukee and Dane County, the two biggest Democrat counties, is, you know, in the offing and needs to be completed by December 1st.
Georgia, as far as we can tell, and this is why we're auditing, because we have very good information, the numbers are going to come out about here that don't have applications. Under the law of the state of Wisconsin, already decided, if there's no application for an absentee ballot, the absentee ballot is thrown away. This all happened in two places. In Wisconsin. Didn't happen in northern Wisconsin. Didn't happen in Republican Wisconsin. Didn't happen in neutral Wisconsin, where there are an equal number of Republicans and Democrats. It happened in a place where the vote was 75-80% for the Democrat.
The other thing that is worthy of investigation in Wisconsin, perhaps in Michigan, but we talked about it on this show in Wisconsin, is the turnout numbers, effectively. Wards in Milwaukee where you had 200% of registered voters vote. And I understand it's you can register on Election Day, in-person registration on Election Day. But, I mean, still, it seems to me that some of these anomalies need to be investigated. The idea that you get that sort of same-day voter registration plus turnout at 1.5 and 2 times the number of people that are on the voter rolls in some of these precincts, the precincts that are coming in, you know, 500-3 for Biden versus Trump. This is another area that they're examining, and it was mentioned. And then the double counting. You know, this goes to the ballot dumps, the alleged ballot dumps that occurred in the wee hours on Wednesday morning, the day after the election. When the vote counts were stopped, and that's a whole nother matter. Sidney Powell has a theory on that, which we'll get to. But Giuliani has affiance in Michigan on the question of the ballot dump that allegedly occurred in Detroit around 4:30 a.m. And also, arguably, and we didn't get the specifics in terms of we really like the sequencing here. When did if the alleged ballot dump, you have affidavits that the alleged ballot dump in Detroit happened at X, you know, at a particular time in the morning hours, then when did it happen? If it did, if you can substantiate it in Philadelphia, when did it happen in Milwaukee? That would be interesting to get the timelines in each of these jurisdictions. But here's Giuliani on the alleged ballot dump in Michigan.
What they swear to is that at 4:30 in the morning, a truck pulled up to the Detroit center where they were counting ballots. The people thought it was food, so they all ran to the truck. It wasn't food. It was thousands and thousands of ballots. And the ballots were in garbage cans, they were in paper bags, they were in cardboard boxes, and they were taken into the center. They were put on a number of tables. At that time, they thought all the Republican inspectors had left, all but two had, and an employee of Dominion, who we will address a little bit later. And here's what they jointly swear to, that every ballot that they could see, everything they could hear, these were ballots for Biden. When they saw a ballot, these were ballots only for Biden, meaning there was no down ticket, just Biden. Many of them didn't have anything on the outer envelope because these ballots were produced very quickly, very swiftly, and they're estimated to be a minimum of 60,000, maximum of 100,000.
Before the hour's up, at the end of the hour, we'll return to this topic, and I'll bring in what Sidney Powell had to say about that count stoppage or count stoppages. And her theory about why the count was stopped and what happened after it was in these various jurisdictions. But coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk to our friend Josh Mitchell, Georgetown political theory professor, about identitarian politics and if and how it will march on through our culture in spite of some of the election losses that were suffered by identitarians on November 3rd. We'll be right back.
Exposing political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to The Dan Proft Show. Jerron Smith was a member of President Trump's administration for a time. We spoke with him on this show. He was an advisor on domestic policy. He had also worked as director of urban affairs and revitalization of the administration, specifically. He went on with Joy Reid, I don't know why, basically to be excoriated as a sellout to his race. Jerron Smith is black. Joy Reid asking him about the Trump election challenges, what he thinks about them, and then what he thinks about what Trump is doing as a black man. How does he reconcile being a black man and watching Trump try to suppress the votes of black Americans? That's essentially her point.
How do you reconcile as a black man in this country and a voter the fact that your party, the Republican Party, continually is focusing on and going after and trying to invalidate the votes of black people in Detroit, in Atlanta, in Milwaukee, and only doing that in places where black people vote?
Well, I would validate that Trump got the biggest vote tally of African-American voters in 60 years. And so I think...
I'm asking you. Hold on a second. Donald Trump, do you know what percentage of the black vote he got? Do you know what percentage?
Saying,
you know what it was?
12%.
Okay, you don't know. Let me ask you again. I'm going to re-ask you the same question.
Well, I mean, you're not even allowing me to talk and respond to you. I'm happy to answer your questions, but if you're going to cut me off in the middle of it, we're not going to have a productive conversation.
It's not possible to have a productive conversation with Joy Reid.
Is that okay? In all of these cities, you know, they're not all black cities. They have white voters there, too. So we're looking at everyone's vote and making sure everyone votes. I think that's what the Trump administration is looking at.
Well,
it's not a racial thing. You had
we'll leave
it.
It is, because these cities are where black people live. But it doesn't bother you. I think you've made that very clear. Jerron Smith, thank you very much for being here. Have a wonderful evening.
The argument is so absurd, but that's the identitarian argument about everything. Jason Whitlock writing over at Outkick.com. I am repulsed by the people who have worked tirelessly for more than 400 years to convince black people that our skin color is our most prized asset and defining characteristic. This conceit originally led to our physical enslavement. It has now led to our mental enslavement. White liberals have convinced black people to take God out of the equation and replace him with Barack Obama, LeBron James, Colin Kaepernick, Black Lives Matter, and all the other approved symbols of unapologetic blackness. I object to this insanity. Love of my skin color is not America's salvation. Random white people loving me is not the key to my happiness, freedom, or success in this country. The worship of skin color creates a dangerous level of racial division. White liberals, socialists, and communists are using black people to promote racial anarchy. Nobody has been more on the mark over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 months writing about racial issues and identitarian politics than Jason Whitlock. And I don't think anybody's been more courageous either in taking on the icons that he takes on in media and entertainment. In addition to just having the temerity to go on Tucker Carlson's show, that's also, of course, a great offense to the black identitarians, the Black Lives Matter crowd, the identitarians across the board, because as he points out, Whitlock does, being driven by white leftists. For more on all things identity politics related and where this goes in the coming years, we're pleased to be joined again by Joshua Mitchell, professor of political theory at Georgetown, author of the just released American Awakening, Identity Politics and Other Afflictions of Our Time. Josh Mitchell, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks Good. For having me.
The sense is that because of pickups in the House by Republicans, unexpected pickups, because of ballot initiatives being defeated in places that were race oriented, in places like California to essentially reinstitute racial preferences, those being defeated so roundly, that identitarian politics and their ideologues really took a blow on November 3rd. My sense is that may be true in an electoral sense in the short term, but that they march on and continue their ascent, really, to power in spite of those results on November 3rd.
Yeah, I do worry about that. The clip that you played from Joy Reid is so very telling. The profound pathology we have at this country at this moment is that we're all denied our individuality, denied the dignity of persons, and relegated simply to our group category. So all black men have to think this way. All women have to think this way. All white heterosexual males are guilty of this profound stain. And that's really the game here. We're trying to come up with a simple way, or rather, identity politics is trying to come up with a simple way to grade every single human being on the planet. I don't know if you know this thing called intersectionality score.
Yes.
Where you figure out how many guilt points you have and where you are in the great hierarchy of what I called transgressions and innocence. And the whole purpose of politics is simply to build a world around the innocent ones and to purge the guilty ones. This is a profound sickness in our country. And as you said, it's an attempt to deal with transgression and innocence without God and, most importantly, without forgiveness.
When we come back with Georgetown political theory professor Josh Mitchell, we'll continue our discussion about the march of identitarian politics and talk a little bit about school curriculums as the vehicle for the advance. More with Josh Mitchell right after this.
This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We're speaking with Georgetown University political theory professor Josh Mitchell about identitarian politics and his new book on the topic. And before the break, we were talking about the identitarians marching on with their Marxist agenda despite losses on election day. How do they do that? Well, one way they do that is by controlling the curriculum in K through 12 school systems. And let me give you an example. In Illinois, and this is just one example, there is a rule that's been proposed by the State Board of Education. So that would be implemented in all of the K through 12 school systems in Illinois if adopted, that would mandate what teachers think, believe, teach, disqualify teachers and lessons plans that don't conform to the culturally responsive teaching and leading standards. This is very similar to the ethnic curriculum requirement that was advanced in California before, somewhat surprisingly, being vetoed by Gavin Newsom. But I think, you know, maybe he's got his eye on bigger things and he just didn't want to take up that fight at this point. It's certainly not like he's not an identitarian, but, you know, there's a time for everything. The culturally responsive teaching standards, the ethnic studies requirements. I mean, this is all in advance of exactly what you were describing identitarian politics to be, and it advances regardless of who's in the Oval Office.
Yeah. So at Georgetown, where I teach, and at other universities, we now have survey questions that our students are supposed to fill out, and one of them is the teacher culturally sensitive? And that's really a code word to say, does this person have the right political opinions? The thing that we most sorely need in our education system and everywhere is diversity of opinion. But that's unlikely to happen. Black people who are conservatives don't count as black people. There's just one way you have to go, and this is a kind of totalitarianism that's creeping in, and we have to fight it. As you said, we've made some electoral pushback, some success here with the latest election. But this has penetrated deep into our culture. And my view of this ultimately is that we're trying to solve a religious problem in politics. The religious problem is, how do we find relief from our guilt? And of course, theologically, you do this through your churches, or if you're Protestant, directly through your relationship with Christ. And when you destroy that idea, but you don't get rid of the guilt, then you try to do it in the world. And so what we're trying to do is to separate the pure from the stained. And this is, my argument is that first, right now we see this coming after white heterosexual men. And please don't misunderstand me. This is not a defense of white heterosexual men.
No, they're terrible.
The logic of this is that once you purge, you know, toxic masculinity, then you're going to go after another group. You have to find somebody who will take upon themselves the sins of the world, somebody you can blame. And it's already beginning to happen. It's white women next. And then after that, irony of ironies, it will probably be black heterosexual men, because black heterosexual men believe in the church, believe in the conventional family. But as you keep pushing this identitarian viewpoint out to the edges, and you get to the defense of transgenderism, anyone who doesn't believe this, anyone who believes that men are men and women are women, are guilty of transphobia. And so the great irony of this is that Black America, which wears the crown of thorns, if you want to use that religious language, which is the basis of the move left, and it was rightly the basis of the civil rights movement. I mean, there are great wounds in America. But the argument goes, civil rights goes to women's rights, goes to gay rights, goes to transgender rights. And when you get to that point, what you have to do if you're defending transgender rights is attack the family as being heteronormative, attack the church as being homophobic, and yet, as Martin Luther King said, and every sensible Black and white person in America knows, we have to have conventional families, and we have to have churches in order for us to live well. So a movement that begins by rightly thinking through the travails that African Americans have been through in America ends by purging those Black Americans who believe in the church and the family, which are the two most important institutions to Black America. So it's really, really perverse, and I'm waiting for Black America to push back on this. My view is that Black America has more moral authority at this moment than it had during the Civil Rights Movement, because Black America alone can say to the Democratic Party, no, it is not the case that the travails of Black America goes to the women's movement, goes to the gay movement, and goes to the transgender movement. So, and there are Black intellectuals who are pushing back against this. I think you know Bob Woodson well.
Yeah, of course.
He is among those who are doing this. So we have a profound disease in our country, and we're not going to return to health until we treat each other as human beings. And by the way, that's what the rule of law does. So I'll be the first to admit that we have all sorts of problems in our country, but all of it can be solved by treating each other under the rubric of the rule of law. We don't have to purge groups. We don't have to say, this group is pure, this group is innocent. We don't have to say, if you're a Black man, you have to believe this, or you're guilty of conspiring with the devil. But that's where the left is today.
So given the election results, how is it that we're losing? It seems that a majority, even in leftist states like California, agree with probably a lot of what you just said. So why does the side that lost on Election Day continue to win in every other cultural venue?
Well, my sense is that this is the last of their wins, and I hope I'm right, is that America really has gotten to the point, most Americans have gotten to the point, where they've had enough of this. They realize they can't just be reduced to their skin color. But these groups that do this are still immensely powerful. They have control of our universities and our education system. They have control of Hollywood. And my sense is they're going to overplay this. They really think that Donald Trump, who was an accident, and my view is that Donald Trump was elected in large part because he did not care about what identitarians were telling him. I mean, what they were telling him is, look at yourself. You're a white man. You should be ashamed of yourself. And Trump said, I don't feel guilty. I'm proud of my country. My country is good. And I'm sick and tired of you telling me what I should and should not think. That's why he really won. And I think Americans, for the most part, know that he's right, whatever you might think of his tweets and all that, but that he's right and that we can't build a world in this way. And the Dems and the left have still think that they have command of this and they're going to overplay it. So I'm standing back and I'm watching and I'm looking for my opportunities.
That is just an outstanding distillation. And you can get more outstanding distillations from Professor Josh Mitchell in his recently released book, American Awakening, Identity, Politics, and Other Afflictions of Our Time. He is Josh Mitchell, professor of political theory at Georgetown University. Josh, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, man. It's great to talk to you.
The podcast of the show at danproffshow.com.
Welcome back to the show. At the top of the hour, we talked about what I've described as the nine buckets of voter fraud allegations that were presented by Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell yesterday afternoon in their press briefing. Talked about the eight that Giuliani went through. The ninth involves mainly Sidney Powell. And she makes an assertion about intentional manipulation of the vote tabulation by the vendors that provide the voting machines as well as the software platform for the counting, that would be, as we've discussed, the greatest instance of political corruption in the history of the Republic. And she's staking her reputation on it. Here's what Sidney Powell had to say specifically about this aspect that I mentioned at the top of the show. The question of the vote stoppages that are alleged in places like Detroit and Philadelphia and Milwaukee. What happened? How did that happen? Why did it happen? And what were they doing? Here's what she says.
But one of its most characteristic features is its ability to flip votes. It can set and run an algorithm that probably ran all over the country to take a certain percentage of votes from President Trump and flip them to President Biden, which we might never have uncovered had the votes for President Trump not been so overwhelming in so many of these states that it broke the algorithm that had been plugged into the system. And that's what caused them to have to shut down in the states they shut down in. That's when they came in the back door with all the mail-in ballots, many of which they had actually fabricated. Some were on pristine paper with identically matching perfect circle dots for Mr. Biden. Others were shoved in batches. They're always put in a certain number of batches, and people would rerun the same batch. This corresponds to our statistical evidence that shows incredible spikes in the vote counts at particular times. And that corresponds to eyewitness testimony of numerous people who have come forward and said they saw the ballots come in the back door at that time.
One of the other statistical anomalies she mentioned, which I wanted to include here in our discussion, was with respect to the spreads. Listen.
We have evidence of different numbers of votes being injected into the system, the same identical, unique six-digit number multiple times in at least two states that we've analyzed so far. And I'm talking about like 341,542 votes for Biden and 100,012 for Trump. There's no explanation, no logical explanation for the same numbers being injected 20 minutes apart into the machine.
There are a lot of statistical anomalies that the math geek should be dispatched to address. We'll address one in Pennsylvania the next hour. You know, I still think this is a long shot. I think this is really a big gamble by Sidney Powell. And as I said all week, I'll give her the benefit of the doubt based on her professional reputation and career that she is going to deliver the goods. But if she doesn't, then it's you know, really the end for her and I think irreparable damage to President Trump.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. You can consider yesterday's press conference that was held by Trump's legal team as sort of an opening statement in the court of public opinion. And both Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell, the two main attorneys, gave closing statements as well that were sort of political in nature. Here are their summations, starting with Rudy.
We cannot allow these crooks, because that's what they are, to steal an election from the American people. They elected Donald Trump. They didn't elect Joe Biden. Joe Biden is in the lead because of the fraudulent ballots, the illegal ballots that were produced and that were allowed to be used after the election was over. Give us an opportunity to prove it in court, and we will.
Okay, well, you're going to have that opportunity. Nobody's stopping you from going to court. Sidney Powell, after her dissertation on really focused on foreign interference in the election, effectively arguing that foreign interests in these election voting machine hardware and software cooked the tabulation of the votes algorithmically. And so here's what she had to say.
And I want the American public to know right now that we will not be intimidated. American patriots are fed up with the corruption from the local level to the highest level of our government. And we are going to take this country back. We are not going to be intimidated. We are not going to back down. We are going to clean this mess up now. President Trump won by a landslide. We are going to prove it.
Landslide.
And we are going to reclaim the United States of America for the people who vote for freedom.
Well, I appreciate her William Wallace moment there, but that's not going to be enough in a court of law. And she has a long way to go in terms of connecting all the dots that she has mapped out with respect to the allegations of hardware and software manipulation to change the counts. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined again by John Nolte. He's the editor-at-large at Breitbart.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Your impressions of what Rudy and Sidney Powell in particular were able to present to bring the public up to speed yesterday.
What I saw was a prosecutor or prosecutors basically doing what prosecutors do. They go before the public. They say, this is what we believe happened. This is who we believe is guilty. This is what it means. Now we have to wait for them to put their case together and do the right thing, which is not to present it on cable TV, but to present it in a court of law where they are criminally liable and under oath if they lie. So I am not feeling any pressure whatsoever. And this is something I think the media is doing to people, especially people on Twitter. We want the evidence now, now, now. You know, they're like little kids in the back. Are we there yet? There's a deadline here. Sidney Powell is not a clown. She's a very serious woman. Another person involved in this is Lynn Wood, another person who has spent a lifetime building a national reputation. These people are not part of the Trump show. These are grownups. And there's a deadline. Sidney Powell is telling us she has the goods. And she's going to present the goods in a court of law instead of on cable news. That's the way it's supposed to be. I can wait 10 days or 2 weeks to see what she has. If she doesn't have what she says, she's done. She's Michael Avenatti.
Yeah,
but
you know,
I can wait 2 weeks to find out.
Yeah, I agree with you. I both about her as well as Lynn Wood. For those of you who don't remember, represented both Richard Jewell against the federal government, as well as, of course,
yep.
Nick Sandman, the Covington Catholic school kid, against something even worse than the federal government, CNN. So you're right about that. Both of them, but especially Sidney Powell, are staking their professional reputation. So I'm inclined to give her the benefit of the doubt. But you're in Adam Schiff territory if you don't prove up. And I mean, what she laid out yesterday is, you know, something out of a Jean Le Carré spy novel, really.
Yeah, and my issue, I'm not sitting here saying she's got the goods. I'm not saying she doesn't have the goods. But what I'm really losing my patience with is people screaming for her to do it now.
Yeah, fair.
As though it's somehow appropriate to present her evidence on Tucker Carlson tonight. It's not. She says she has the goods. I'm an adult. I can wait. Let's see what she brings to court. Or if she doesn't bring anything to court. What is the harm in waiting another 10 days or 2 weeks before people? And I'm not talking about you guys. But
yeah.
If you look at Twitter now, everybody's jumping down her throat. When did our country become so demented that we think we're supposed to make a criminal case on Tucker Carlson tonight? It's ridiculous. She's doing the right thing. But if she doesn't have the goods, she is done. She's a laughingstock, and she deserves to be.
Well, yeah, but
that's what they need to do.
Right. But John, I mean, a couple of things here. First of all, Rudy did present some evidence at that press conference. Secondly, I think he needs to, because this is being prosecuted in both a court of public opinion and courts of law. And they necessarily need to keep the public up to speed and coming along with them, understanding what they're doing and the arguments they're making, hearing the quality of the arguments. You don't have to present every exhibit that they're culling together. But they need to be in a position where if the courts start ruling in their favor, if they do have the goods, as you said, that the public finds those decisions legitimate. And so I think it was smart to do this briefing at this stage. They're far enough along. They've gathered enough evidence. But when he's presenting affidavits and he's naming names, because, for example, that woman in Detroit, Jessie Jacob, who works for the city of Detroit and provided an affidavit about what she believed to be improper activities and vote counting in Detroit, you know, that's a good example. And Rudy made the point, look, affidavits are evidence. It's not the sum total of evidence. I probably need more physical evidence to support the claim. But I've got affidavits of people who will testify in a court of law to X, Y, and Z. And that's relevant. And that can easily be dismissed, even if the press corps wants to dismiss it. I think it's important so that we have something even on talk radio and elsewhere to talk about with the public and have it disseminate on social media and elsewhere to say, you know, you can't just wave off people who Americans who don't have any particular political motivations that are obvious, that are saying there were things that were happened that I saw that were wrong.
I can wait till next week for this or the week after. I don't know why they need to present it in front of a brain media that is just going to destroy it. You know, yeah, they present it a little bit, but I'm talking about the overall case. I'm talking about the case that Sidney Powell is talking about.
Yeah, okay.
Why can't we wait 10 days?
No, I can wait for it, but it is interesting. I mean, you know, look, short attention spans in this country, this just in. And you say, like, the media is putting a lot of pressure, the D.C. press corps putting a lot of pressure on. That's exactly right. But you have to recognize that that pressure does have an effect, and you have to respond to the reality on the ground. That's part of the reality on the ground.
If this is what she says it is, and I don't know if it is or not, this is massive.
Of course.
This is the biggest political scandal in our country times 10. If this is what she says it is. And I do not want her prosecuting this case, presenting her case
agreed.
On TV.
Agreed.
I don't want her doing that.
Agreed. I'm not.
I can wait 10 days.
Yeah, I know, but that's not really my point. I can wait, too. My point is to say you still need to communicate with the public about what you think the story is. And you also need to communicate with the public if you want to make a declaration like she made yesterday, calling for the DOJ to initiate a criminal investigation post-haste. I mean, those are the sorts of things that bring the public along with the arguments that are starting to take form.
I think they did. I think yesterday they said this is what we believe. This is who we believe is guilty. And we're going to prove it in the next couple of weeks. I don't know what more they could have done with that than that. If they don't come up with it, this is going to be a catastrophe for them. And it's going to be a catastrophe for Trump. It could potentially ruin any chance he has of running again in 2024.
Yeah, so,
and they deserve all of that if they don't come up with it. But this, I don't understand this, you know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? I just don't get it. I just don't.
Well, okay. But so going back to where the public stands right now, too, because they're germane to this discussion, as you're describing, this what the reaction will be if they don't present the goods, both for the team as well as for Trump. You wrote about this. It was interesting. About half the country says it's likely Democrats stole the election. So it seems like the right now, at least, you still have a majority of Republicans and nearly half the country overall saying that, I tend to lend some credibility to the allegations that Trump and his campaign are making.
Yeah. I mean, when you have 47% of the public, 30% of Democrats saying it was likely or very likely that the Democrats stole the election. I mean, this is a good pollster. This isn't some media pollster that's been lying to us for four election cycles. This is a good pollster. And that is huge. That's massive. 47%, 50% say it wasn't likely. Only 41%, it definitely wasn't likely. So I think they probably have done a pretty good job of presenting their case, and that we shouldn't let CNN
right.
and Twitter convince us otherwise, because people are watching this and they don't live in the media bubble like we do. And they're going, you know, this kind of stinks. And I'll tell you something. I've never seen in my life ever, and I've watched election nights now going back to 1984. I've never seen them stop counting, ever. And yeah. That is a problem.
It is a problem.
That is a problem. And then you see Trump winning, and then all of a sudden, boom, Chicago, Milwaukee, Detroit, Atlanta, and Philadelphia just shut down. And when they turn back on, what happens? It's just Biden votes. Now, I don't know if there's anything going on there, but I'm telling you, that stinks. And I think that's another thing people are looking at. And I think that might be where Sidney Powell is going to zero in.
Well, she offered a theory on why the stop happened. And again, if she can prove that up in a court of law, then, we really have something, as you described, 10x anything that's ever happened in this country on the political corruption front. John Nolte, editor-at-large, Breitbart.com. John, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Have a good weekend.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Our friend John Solomon over at justthenews.com reached out to Williams College professor Stephen Miller. He's a Yale and Princeton trained math expert. He analyzed Pennsylvania ballot data and did a bunch of phone interviews too, data from phone interviews of voters in Pennsylvania. Two patterns he found concerning. One involved possible votes that were not counted. the other ballots that appear to be requested by someone other than a registered voter. Miller said in a sworn statement provided to Just the News, I estimate that the number of ballots that were either requested by someone other than the registered Republican or requested and returned but not counted range from 89,397 to 98,801. It's a specific range. According to Pennsylvania state data for early and absentee ballot requests, there are roughly 165,000 ballots requested in the names of registered Republican voters that had not been counted as of November 16th. Well, that's interesting. And again, you know, keep the spread in mind here. The spread between Biden and Trump in Pennsylvania is about 82,000 votes. Rudy Giuliani saying that Pennsylvania, not a Biden victory, but a fraud.
Biden, which is not a victory. It's a fraud. It's 69,140 votes. The reality is that we are now at a count of 682,770 ballots for which we have affidavits that there was no inspection of that ballot at the time that it was entered in the vote.
Yeah, so that's a bit of a misleading statement, or it could be taken in a way, I think, perhaps other than what it was intended, to be generous to Giuliani. Number one, there seems to be some discrepancy in how many votes they're down in Pennsylvania. Number two, yes, there's the issue of checking the mail-in ballots, like doing signature verification. But he's not saying he has 682,000 affidavits. He's suggesting that because they weren't checked, those 682,000 votes should be set aside. And that's one of those examples where I don't think there is even the remotest of chance that the courts, including the high court, are going to see setting aside that many votes based on, again, if that's proven up, based on that failure of election authorities as the least intrusive remedy for that failure. Giuliani also, on a more interesting issue, which is the equal protection issue of curing ballots in Pennsylvania, gave a concrete example of what he's talking about so people could understand the problem with allowing some people to, quote unquote, cure their ballot and other people not provided that opportunity because, you know, it's against state law.
One of our plaintiffs, Mr. Henry, cast a absentee ballot and he failed to put it in the secure envelope inside. He just put it in open, naked. That ballot was cast aside because it was invalid, because that breaks the privacy of the vote. In Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia, if they noticed that there wasn't an inner envelope, they'd contact the voter and allow him to vote again. Or if he didn't fill it out completely, or if he made a mistake and didn't sign his full name, he was allowed to cure it. There is no such provision under the law of Pennsylvania. The Democrat Secretary of State made that up.
Mm-hmm. And again, the equal protection claim calls to mind Bush v. Gore. It's not exactly on point, but substantively, the argument is just as counting Chads one way in one county in Florida and counting them another way in another county is an equal protection problem, and that was a supermajority of the court ruling that. So is the idea that some people could come back and cure their ballot in some counties in Pennsylvania and other people can't or weren't afforded the opportunity. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Greg Tufel. He is the founder of OGC Law LLC based in Pittsburgh. So he's there on the ground in Pennsylvania with some perspective, legal perspective. We appreciate Greg Tufel. Thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, of the various buckets of voter fraud allegations, as I'm terming them, from the poll watchers to the lack of inspection of absentee ballots to the curing of ballots, where do you see the most upside for the Trump campaign in Pennsylvania?
Well, you just mentioned the data where you get into, and you've got about a 81,000-82,000 vote split. The most promising situations are in terms of actually changing the result in PA among the lawsuits and the issues raised so far, I would say have to do with, you know, Republican votes not being counted or Republican votes being turned away because of lack of provisional ballots available at the polling station. And as you just mentioned, you know, districts with or the counties, I guess, with more Republicans having not having the kind of curing that's happening in the counties with more Democrats.
So, Greg, the unanswered questions with respect to Pennsylvania, do we know yet, though, how many ballots were collected and counted that arrived after November 3rd? And in addition to that, do we know whether they were separated from the overall vote totals because the Pennsylvania Supreme Court had exceeded its authority and usurped the legislative function?
So that's something that still needs to be nailed down. But I can tell you two data points, so to speak. One is that in Pennsylvania primary, there were over 60,000 votes received after Election Day that were counted. So you'd expect in the general election the number to be upwards of that number because there's so many more votes in the general election generally. However, I've also seen a quote from Secretary of State McFarr claiming that there were only in the range of 10,000 votes that were counted after Election Day. And there have also seen stories reported about various counties either confirming or not confirming that they did segregate the ballots. I haven't really seen that fully audited to the point of did they really segregate them. You know, initially, I know they polled the various counties and only 25 of them were able to quickly confirm that they were segregating the ballots, and then that's why the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and ordered that segregation occur. And that was after, by the way, the PA Supreme Court refused to order segregation. And then initially, Secretary of State Buchbar claimed to the U.S. Supreme Court, you don't need to order segregation to occur. I've already done that. I've already directed all the counties to segregate. And initially, the Supreme Court was satisfied with that representation, but then when they went around surveying the counties to see if they were actually following Secretary Buchbar's direction to segregate ballots, they couldn't get confirmation from more than half of them. I think ultimately they I saw it reported that some 63 of the counties were able to confirm they did segregate. So I don't know what happened with the last four. I never saw those confirmed.
When we come back with Pittsburgh attorney Greg Tufel, I want to talk about the votes that Justice Alito ordered set aside and whether or not there's a handle on how many of those votes there might be and whether they were, in fact, set aside. More with Greg Tufel right after.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're speaking with Pittsburgh attorney Greg Tufel. Before the break, talking about those votes that were to be segregated in Pennsylvania by order of Justice Alito, votes that were received by Pennsylvania authorities after Election Day, then why don't we have a general handle on what that overall number is?
I don't know why not. They weren't directed to count and report the total number of segregated ballots. That information will certainly come up in the lawsuit,
I would think. Something else, too, you know, this Pennsylvania Supreme Court is really an interesting body when they're not writing election law. I agree with Giuliani, at least on this point. This decision about poll watchers, that there's no right to be within a certain distance. I mean, you don't have to specify the number of feet, but obviously the whole point of having a poll watcher is so that they are within eyeshot of the ballot counting process so they can see what's happening. The idea that that they don't have to be effectively. Well, now they've just overturned essentially the substantive election statute in the state of Pennsylvania, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. The reason why in Pennsylvania it's important that you have poll watchers close enough to see what's going on. Under Pennsylvania law for absentee and mail-in ballots, it states very clearly that the mail-in ballot is not valid where the outer envelope is not certified by the elector or really signed by the voter, basically. And it's not valid, as I think you just mentioned, if there's no secrecy ballot, or I think we're having a quote from Rudy Giuliani saying
right.
if there's no secrecy ballot, it gets rejected. That's another reason. So it has to have a secrecy envelope inside, and then it has to be put aside and not counted. If the secrecy ballot has any markings which tend to indicate the political preferences of the voter, if it says, you know, go Trump, go Biden, whatever on the bed, that has to be put aside. So these various issues, when they opened it, was there a secrecy ballot? You need to be relatively close to see that. Was the outside envelope signed? You need to be relatively close to see that. Were there any improper markings on the secrecy ballot? You need to be relatively close to see that. You're not going to see that from 15 feet away with someone hunkered over a desk filing through envelopes. And once they tear away the outside envelope and tear away the secrecy envelope and pull out the ballot itself has no one's name on it. It's untraceable. You have now destroyed any ability to validate that they did it properly. So there's one shot and one shot only. Not a recount can fix this. You need to be close enough to see what's going on to make sure it's being done properly. If you believe that more of the mail-in ballots favored Biden than favored Trump, then you would have an incentive to accept as many of those mail-in ballots as you could if you were eager to see that Biden wins and you're not ethically handling the election. That is why you need someone standing by, making sure they're not willy-nilly accepting ballots that are invalid under the law, because they're just trying to count as many for Biden as they can, regardless of whether they follow the law, regardless of whether it's signed by the elector, regardless of whether there's a secrecy ballot, regardless of whether there's markings on a secrecy ballot. If they could get away with it, and if they were so motivated, then they could be counting lots and lots of ballots, especially in counties where you expect not only the mail-in votes to favor Biden, but to favor him heavily. So that's why you need. It matters that you have meaningful poll watching going on, and if when you have, like they had reported in Philadelphia and in Pittsburgh, poll watchers being denied meaningful access in various ways. Cameras not even in the stand. They'll comment in the media that well, there were cameras, you know, even if you couldn't stand close enough. But there's complaints that the cameras weren't focused
right,
in a way to allow proper right. inspection either.
But do you agree with me, though, that the idea that you would get, say, the United States Supreme Court to set aside 682,000 ballots based on that infirmity is highly unlikely?
Yeah, it's an uphill battle. I mean, your standard of evidence prove voter fraud sufficient to overturn an election is generally clear and convincing evidence. You would need some sort of whistleblower type evidence where someone said, yeah, they kept all the poll watchers back, but actually I was close enough to see, and I swear, you know, this is what the person was doing. They were counting votes with no secrecy ballot. They were counting votes with no signature. If you could get enough evidence that not only could they have done that, but they actually did that, they actually improperly counted votes to, you know, sufficiently undermine the confidence in the election, then you could potentially get a court to rule that, you know, to throw out the election results in various ways. There's different kinds of remedies. Also, I mean, an overlooked potential is ultimately it's up to the House to accept the electoral votes from any given state. So if you could persuade the House to vote to refuse to accept the votes from the electoral votes from a particular state based on fraud or based on so many irregularities that they just don't trust the results.
Yeah.
And again, you could, but again, it's an extremely high standard to get Congress to electoral college.
He is Greg Tufel. He's the founder of OGC Law, LLC, based in Pittsburgh. Appreciate your perspective on your legal perspective on all things Pennsylvania election related. Greg, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nationwide. The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. Well, with New York City schools shutting down again and the goalpost being moved in order to do that, it was a very good choice that Martha McCallum made over at Fox News to have Randy Weingarten on, the head of the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, one of the lead union thugs in the country, and and go right after her about the closing of the New York City schools. because she's the one actually in charge. Let's dispense with the notion that Cuomo or de Blasio or the New York City schools chancellor is in charge. Let's go right to who's actually in charge of the schools and ask her why they're shutting down. And so Randy Weingarten appeared. We'll get to that in a second. But we start with a rather remarkable statement in the sense that he had the political courage to make it in the face of the teachers' unions, not in the sense that it isn't overwhelmingly supported by the evidence. But CDC Director Redfield, before the press yesterday, on kids in school during this spike in cases.
K through 12 schools can operate with face-to-face learning, and they can do it safely, and they can do it responsibly. The infections that we've identified in schools, when they've been evaluated, were not acquired in schools. The truth is, for kids K through 12, one of the safest places they can be, from our perspective, is to remain in school.
One of the safest places they can be, from our perspective, is to remain in school. It's not your perspective. It's the science and data, to borrow the favorite cant of the left. And so McCallum to Randy Weingarten. Why are you shutting down the schools?
The problem is that schools are not impervious to all that is going on in the outside. And what the mayor saw today or the last couple of days is that in Staten Island and other regions in the city, you were seeing a trajectory that was going way up. And so what Mike Mulgrew and the UFT and others are saying to the city, begging the city, wear your mask. Get the infection rate down because we want schools to be reopened safely.
The schools need to be open is the point. The kids need to be in the schools because what's been decided by the CDC, it sounds like the union doesn't want the teachers in the classroom and the mayor doesn't want the teachers in the classroom. The parents clearly want the teachers in the classroom and the CDC wants them in the classroom.
You're actually not listening to me. What has happened here is that New York City was the only major school district in the nation to actually reopen schools
safely. But they're closing now, Randy. Why are they closing now, Martha?
They're closing now because what the city said, and frankly, what lots of other places are also seeing, is a huge skyrocketing increase
in the virus surge. You're not listening to me.
We need to actually listen to the science here, Randy, because the science says,
yes, everyone agrees. We see a spike. We're in a second wave. You and I totally agree on that. What they're telling us, though, is that the wisest scientific move is to have children in school.
Exactly. Or I guess you could just drop them off at a bar since bars are staying open, at least at 25% capacity, right, in New York. And elsewhere, not everywhere, but in some places. But yeah, the point is what we know about schools, what we've known for months and months on end, not just in America, but throughout Western Europe as well, particularly in those countries where the schools never really shut down. And it wasn't just Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, too, that did some version of lockdown policies, but not with respect to schools. We know that the transmission rates are lower. We also know what the survival rates are. So the question is, the science is overwhelming. The CDC, which normally the left likes to lean on when they get the information they want to prosecute their case for lockdowns or mandatory mask wearing or other such restrictions, being dismissed out of hand. Why? How is that? As McCallum said, it seems like you don't want teachers in school and de Blasio doesn't want teachers in school, but the parents do. And we also know, of course, what the negative effects are, as McCallum made some reference to. And we've talked about in detail over and over and over again. Negative effects on the kids are. Talked about the report out from the Dallas Independent School District this week about how far behind kids in that system have fallen. And we knew this in the spring, frankly. And we're pretending this is sui generis. It's not. It's lockdown 2.0, impact 2.0, same things. So why is it happening? Are you starting to finally understand, some people, do you think, are finally starting to understand what the mission of so many government K through 12 school systems is, their mission focus? It's not on educating kids. They're set up for the benefit and the convenience of the adults. These school systems are mainly third-party administrators to confer salaries and benefits on the adults in the system. And the kids are a secondary thought. And if you didn't believe that statement before, are you coming around to that belief when you listen to Randy Weingarten and you see the goalposts being moved so that teachers can stay out of school? after you watched the demands that were made by teachers unions around the country to go back to school that had nothing to do with school safety, nothing to do with COVID. Pass the Green New Deal. Give us money for that. Give us more employees for the union. Nothing to do with COVID, and certainly nothing to do with educating children. I mean, just here again, I'll give you stats from Illinois, since I know it best, my home state. For kids in K through 12, this is Illinois stats only, 99.99% survival rate. There have been 8 deaths out of more than 80,000 recorded cases. Also in Illinois, 99.82 survival rate for people aged 20 to 49 who are infected with COVID. And that's actually a bit lower than the national number, which is like 99.98 under 50. But anyway, 99.82. under the age of 50. 77% of teachers in Illinois are younger than 50. So you have 3/4 of the teachers in Illinois under the age of 50. That cohort has a 99.82% survival rate on infection. Kids K through 12 age, 99.99. And you're saying that on balance, they shouldn't be in school because it's unsafe because there's a case spike. Oh, well, they're not insulated from the outside world. No, I know. And they haven't been insulated from the outside world during the last several months for the schools that have been open or during the last couple of weeks since cases started spiking. And what do we see? A much reduced incidence of transmission, much less hospitalization and death in schools than in larger society. So what is the problem again? And what is the basis to keep kids out? Because the systems are set up for the benefit and the convenience of the adults. And this is what they want because they can demand it. And why take a chance when you don't have to? Why extend yourself when you don't have to? And I know there are exceptions, both in terms of systems and teachers, general statements. But this is the command control nature of K through 12 education in America that needs to be rethought. Absolutely needs to be rethought. The system is incapable of producing what you want it to produce because they're mainly focused on insulating themselves from competition, owning politicians, and telling you how it's going to be for your kids based on their interests, not your kids.
DanProfShow.com.
Welcome back to the show. Continuing our conversation about K through 12 education and COVID lockdowns. By the way, it's not just government schools that they're coming after, of course. Tim Carney, our friend over at the Washington Examiner, tweeted out, as the scientific consensus builds that closing schools is not a prudent intervention, my county government tells private schools they should close. This is county, and he posts a letter from County Executive Mark Elrick and Health Officer Travis Scales. By the way, just as a quick aside on Mark Elrick, you remember him, the Montgomery County Executive? Several months ago, he had an outdoor press conference announcing countywide restrictions in Montgomery County, Maryland. And he was the one who got heckled by Montgomery County residents and interrupted a number of times in large measure because he was such an imperious D-bag in announcing these restrictions and dismissive of the concerns of his constituents. So that was a fun one because he really got raked over the coals by Montgomery County residents. And I hope he does here. Carney goes on to tweet, you would have thought that after 3 months of open schools and very low transmission in schools and all the science since then, Elrick and Gales would have realized they made a mistake when they tried to close all private schools in July and August. You would have thought that, but you would have been wrong. Because if you would have thought that, you don't understand the nature of these politicians that are seizing on COVID-19 as the means to aggrandize their power and expand their control over you, expanding government in the process. Power, the pursuit of power. Another sort of tangential issue, but at a private school nonetheless, the purge continues. Safetyism, the totalitarianism of safetyism continues, Montgomery County. The Purge, also a feature of totalitarian cultures, states, cultures, continues as well. This is from La Jolla Country, La Jolla County Day School, I should say. Apparently, he had a real problem at this private school. I think this is a school that maybe Tucker Carlson went to. I'm not sure. Real crisis over there. You know what happened? They had a student wear a MAGA hat. Yeah. A student at La Jolla County Day School wore a MAGA hat to school. The head of the school, Gary Cron, we had a student wear a MAGA hat today. I have talked with that student who now understands why the hat is offensive to our community. He will not wear it again. In addition, his mom said that she is embarrassed by his actions. She will fulfill her role as a parent. We will continue to grow as a community that sees and values the dignity of all people. Except those who wear MAGA hats. Right, Gary? This is Dan Proft.
This is the Dan Proft Show. The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft. And this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. Follow us at danproftshow.com, where you can find podcasts and program, as you can on Spotify and iTunes. At Dan Proft Show and at Dan Proft on social media, including Parler. I'm a recent entrant into Parler, the Parler arena, so enjoying that. Getting back to the election challenges and all of the detail that was laid out by Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell yesterday. Focusing on Sidney Powell, because I think she has the tougher case to make out, certainly tougher case to pull together the necessary evidence to perhaps support the inclusion of forensic software experts to get hold of source code from these election machine vendors and whatnot. And I got to say, I mean, and I'm not ridiculing Powell here, but just on the merits, her opening statement at that press conference on Thursday afternoon was something out of a John le Carré spy novel.
What we are really dealing with here and uncovering more by the day is the massive influence of communist money through Venezuela, Cuba, and likely China in the interference with our elections here in the United States. The Dominion voting systems, the Smartmatic technology software, and the software that goes in other computerized voting systems here as well, not just Dominion, were created in Venezuela at the direction of Hugo Chavez to make sure he never lost an election after one constitutional referendum came out the way he did not want it to come out. We have one very strong witness who has explained how it all works. His affidavit is attached to the pleadings of Lynn Wood in the lawsuit he filed in Georgia. It is a stunning, detailed affidavit because he was with Hugo Chavez while he was being briefed on how it worked. He was with Hugo Chavez when he saw it operate to make sure the election came out his way. That was the express purpose for creating this software. He has seen it operate, and as soon as he saw the multiple states shut down the voting on the night of the election, he knew the same thing was happening here, that was what had gone on.
For more on this and reaction, we're pleased to be joined again by Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to American Spectator. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
She described the Kraken. She didn't release it on Thursday afternoon.
Yeah, I think that's right. The Kraken needs to be released in court, right? I mean, these are sort of evidentiary matters that have to be put out before a trier of fact, which the media in America is not, if it ever has been. I think it's okay to preview it. And one of the things that strikes me about that entire press conference yesterday is the overwhelming media reaction to the you know, to the point that, well, you know, this is a lot of baseless allegations. And, you know, you didn't say that about Jeffrey Goldberg when he brought out this suckers and losers thing with anonymously, you know, sourced, if unsourced, allegations. You didn't say that about the New York Times's quote unquote expose of Trump's tax records or the Trump Russia thing or any of these other things that were clearly baseless or, you know, shoddily sourced. And yet, you know, they're running around with affidavits that, you know, it's okay to call it hotly contested or controversial. They're running around saying it's baseless. And, you know, I think it was obvious by Sidney Powell's tone that she understood what she was saying was massive and historic.
Yeah.
And that the implications of those allegations are, you know, massive and historic. And, you know, it's basically the end of her career if she can't at least get people to discuss what she's saying in serious terms.
Right.
And that it's an uphill battle because the media is not going to, you know, give her the time of day on this. They're going to call her a kook.
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. And the challenge she has is getting from, and by the way, the idea that it's baseless, number one, affidavits, it's not baseless. That Rudy Giuliani is right to say that is evidence. It's evidence that can be contested, but it's still evidence. These are still real people statements under threat of perjury. Number two, the some of the history of these companies in question is really not in controversy. There have been controversies around them that are relevant. It doesn't mean that voter fraud occurred. It doesn't mean that they were the purveyors of any said voter fraud. But you can't say that these are just baseless accusations. I mean, there's historical record here. But it seems to me that she's got to get over the hurdle of getting a handle on the back end of these systems to see if there are trails that can substantiate the story that she's telling and get, you know, forensic computer software auditors on these systems to make out her claim. It's going to take more than affidavits, I guess, is the upshot. It's going to take some physical evidence.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, you're going to need a large mountain of eyewitness testimony, whether it's from whistleblowers inside those companies or election officials and, you know, and other such things, you know, which, you know, Sidney Powell didn't build a reputation as one of the best lawyers in the country, you know, not being able to do these things. So, you know, I think it's certainly valid to have watched that press conference and go, wow, they're going to need to prove all this stuff. But, you know, just having that reaction does not mean that you dismiss the entire thing as, oh, you'll never prove that. Assumedly, they recognize the difficulty of the task and are prepared for, you know, dealing with that. And if so, then obviously, you know, you're talking about from the practice of law. I mean, you have shot the moon and you've made yourself a legend if you're able to make this kind of stuff stick. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think you're right in that, you know, Rudy's presentation, which had to do with the old school voter fraud stuff. I mean, I think most everything that Rudy said was pretty unassailable. I mean, if you start talking about Pennsylvania and essentially the allegation is you're running one election in the Republican counties and another election in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, and that's a, you know, classic equal protection case. If you can prove all of these different things, which most of it in Pennsylvania is not all that hard to prove, right? I mean,
well, I think the only thing that was assailable was Giuliani's Joe Pesci impersonation. That was assailable. But in terms of the substance of the matter, yeah, I mean, you could argue whether or not it's likely, for example, that because there was no poll watchers, you were going to get any court in the land, including the highest one, to set aside 680,000 votes. That's not going to happen. But he's still making a legitimate claim of fraud, and then you're arguing about what the remedy is. That is not, you know, beyond the pale. That is, you know, well within the normal bounds of what you would be arguing before a judge and what he most likely will be. And there's all these other buckets of voter fraud allegations, like, as you say, are sort of normal course of business, but perhaps happened on a grander scale. It really is the Sidney Powell allegations that are something of a different kind entirely.
Well, and you know, one thing I can say is, you know, and I'm sure you've seen all the same YouTube videos and different pieces of statistical analysis that I've seen. There are way too many things going on, especially in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, you know, from the standpoint of the ballot counting and you know, some of the statistical patterns that show up in those election results that just don't happen and need to be explained some sort of way. But one point I want to make on this is, yes, all of this is going to get in front of a judge, but I don't know that judges are the ultimate arbiters of how all this is going to go. I think, you know, the aim of all this, I think, pretty clearly is get this stuff in front of a judge and bottle up the certifications of these elections so that when you get to early December and it's time to start slating electors, you're now in front of state legislators in these places that are Republicans, whose constituents are, you know, overwhelmingly for Trump, who are looking at what Biden wants to do, which now we get to find out after having nothing whatsoever during the course of the election.
Scott McKay, publisher at the Hayride, contributor to the American Spectator. Thanks for joining us, Scott. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Dan. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show, departing from the Trump electoral challenges briefly. I note this latest innovation from the lockdown and bust governors. This is Kate Brown in Oregon. And by the way, I don't know if you saw it, but they've got these. Somebody tweeted, I retweeted at Dan Proft. Andrew Cuomo clingers that you can put outside your window with him looking in your window. So it looks like he's looking in your window, like he's peeking up, like just, you know, from his nose to his forehead. And I suggest they do a limited edition series to include, you know, all of the lockdown and bus governors and mayors. So your, you know, governors like Inslee and Pritzker and Whitmer and Newsom and mayors like Lightfoot and Durkin and Bowser and Garcetti. You know, think about how much fun for the family that would be. But back to Kate Brown. Here's an interesting innovation. You know, now they're openly into regulating what goes on in your private home, within your home, in your private space. We've moved beyond public space now to home, people's homes with a holiday setting in. In Oregon, part of the two-week freeze that was decreed on November 13th, limiting social get-togethers indoors and outdoors to no more than six people total from no more than two households. So that includes in your homes. We have the mask mandate to wear in your homes in Pennsylvania. And the hit parade keeps coming because, you know what? Stay safe. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Joachim Buch, visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research. Joachim, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I hope you're staying safe, Joachim. Stay safe. Everybody Absolutely. Stay safe. Yeah. Mm-hmm. this is what
everybody
you,
stay safe.
This
yeah.
is this is what you wrote about, the bastardization of our language that's happening with you know, many most not noticing.
Yeah, it's a topic I keep coming back to, like this corona nightmare that never passes. And I've been writing about it a couple of times, how just like these tiny, tiny things in how we deal with the pandemic, but in language, right? Like instead of saying, you know, oh, the infection or the lockdowns or the restrictions, we say like these new times or, you know,
in current circumstances, or like we just make these like really awkward, cumbersome things. And the latest thing that I've noticed is how a lot of people just like ask you to stay safe. And the thing that actually made me write this article and actually made me really upset about it was a super, you know, innocent thing that somebody said over the phone, right? So I was talking to a customer service representative for an order that I'd ordered, completely had nothing to do with Corona, nothing to do with like health or anything at all. And when she was finished and we've all settled our things, you know, like we have these normal platitudes and like the polite things that we ask at the end. And then after all of that, she said, stay safe. And I was like, wait, what? This has nothing to do with Corona and you're advising me to stay safe. Like, what exactly is this supposed to mean? Like,
Is it
going to help me?
Well, this is the new solidarity, right? This is the way to let you know that she is a thoughtful, caring person because she wants you to stay safe because, you know, we're all under threat of death because of the virus.
Yeah, I'm so glad that she's thinking about me and she's so concerned about my health. But seriously, my health doesn't really respond to what she's saying. Like, and to me, this is just like, it becomes this slacktivism that I also commented on, like this trend of, we don't actually have to do anything in the world. We just have to say things about the world and then everything is fine. You know, we can say stay safe and then we're all going to be safe. We can say all kinds of things that aren't real. You know, the United States was founded in 1619 all of a sudden because that's what the New York Times was saying. Like, okay, like, no, there's still like a binding reality out there and you can't just invent new words to suit your ideas all the time.
Well, you know, what's interesting. I mean, this has become a bit of a cliche, but the idea that the trends that were happening before COVID have just increased in pace. And there's something to that in terms of migratory patterns and so forth. There's also something to that in terms of the intrusion of government. And it seems to me one of the things that a lot of these politicians I was describing before you joined us have figured out is that, maybe identitarian politics isn't the play, got sort of beaten back at the ballot on November 3rd, despite Biden's apparent victory, we'll see. But the play for the sort of control over the citizenry that we desire is safetyism. That's something where you can scare enough people, you grab their attention, and you give them a virtue signaling that is less open to criticism because, hey, I'm just concerned about your health. I'm not calling you a racist. I'm just, with like identitarian politics, I'm just concerned about your health. So, hey, why don't you go ahead and put on the mask? You know, why don't you go ahead and take your kids out of school? Why don't you go ahead and shut down your business? You know, because I'm concerned about saving your life.
Yeah, like I'm just trying to help you. Like, what was that? What was that Ronald Reagan quote? Like the scariest word in the English language is,
"I'm from the government. I'm
here to help."
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so, yeah. That's not nice. And I was just finishing another piece reflecting on how these restrictions, government imposed restrictions, create all kinds of conflict between people where ordinarily there wouldn't have been any conflict. And I was thinking about a bunch of mundane interactions, you know, going into a store, getting some kind of service or getting your hair cut or visiting or having food in a restaurant or something like that. And normally that wouldn't be a problem, right? Like the restaurant owner wants to sell you food and you want to buy food. Like your incentives are aligned, if you wish. You want the same thing. But now when we have all these restrictions, you can only be a certain number of people inside, you can only be a certain number of people seated at the same time. You have to, you know, keep a lot of space and distance between you. Waitresses are forced to sort of uphold a government regulation that says, no, you can't be more than 10 people inside. And then, okay, the restaurant fills up, there are 10 people inside, and then there's a big line outside just waiting to get inside. The people want to get inside, there's tons of space, the waitress says, no, I'm sorry, and the tensions just get worse and worse and worse.
Well, right. There's 11 people inside, and then somebody outside snitches, and then the commissars come for the business and find them. It also promotes that snitch culture.
Yeah, absolutely, right? Like, I've been wondering so often why waitresses or security guards or other people who are like clearly negatively affected by this are so adamant on enforcing the rules. Like, why don't they just ignore them and let people in? You know, it's like you're definitely harming people. You're making life harder than they would have had to be. But then again, of course, like there's this like threat hanging over them. They might lose their job.
Right.
The restaurant owner may lose their license.
Well,
it's not worth it anymore, right?
Yeah, and this is something else too. The way these edicts are being addressed. A good example is Cuomo was asked in New York about his 10-person limit, just like, you know, Kate Brown's 6-person limit in Oregon. And he said, well, you know, and the reporter asked, well, how can you enforce it? It's not whether it's legitimate. It's not whether it's a gross infringement upon people's liberties. It's how do you enforce it? And Cuomo's like, yeah, that's a different question. It's really hard. It's hard to restrict. It's hard to regulate. It's very hard to police. So, yeah, it's hard to police. But, you know, if you see it, you stop it. And that's it. So the reaction is it's not there's no you start from the premise that it's legitimate. It's just an enforcement problem.
Yeah. And it's so scary how by doing that, you're also making ordinary citizens into police officers almost. Like you're encouraging the snitch culture that you mentioned, or like at least, you know, everybody's got to speak up and everybody has to police everybody else. Like you're making a rule that you're not enforcing centrally. You're not, the power isn't coming from the government practically. The power is coming from everybody else. And we're just like, we turn into the society where everybody's governing everybody else's actions. And that's really, really scary.
Yeah, deputizing all these COVID enthusiasts out there. He is Joakim Buch. He is visiting scholar at the American Institute for Economic Research. Joakim, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Come on, baby, won't you do it?
Political fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the show. We switch gears a little bit from our discussion of COVID to a more general discussion, which probably in some respects would include the policy responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Chump effect. It was a great man who once ran for governor of Illinois who said that Illinois isn't broken, as the politicians say, it's fixed. In other words, the fix was in against people who play by the rules and finance a government that fleeces them. That great man, of course, was me. And that's what I meant about what our next guest calls the Chump effect, the idea that government is aligned against the interests of its constituents, and that there are in kleptocracies, and there are a number of them around the country, perhaps none more pronounced than my home state of Illinois, where people don't recoil in horror at corruption. They look at how the system works and they say, oh, I see. In order for me to get my special deal, my waiver, my inside play, this is what I got to do. It's a sort of a cut me in or cut it out. And the more people that get cut in, even for just a little bit, just enough to wet their beak, as one might say, become part of extending the kleptocracy. That's what we have in Illinois. That's what we've had in Chicago for a long time. That's what you see in other former or semi-current machine cities around the country. And to some extent, that's what you see at the federal level now, too, isn't it? The so-called swamp. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by James Meggs, co-host of the How Do We Fix It podcast and the former editor of Popular Mechanics, who's coined the term the Chump effect to describe what I call the fix, I guess, back in the day. You see what I did there. James Meggs, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here, Dan.
So in your piece, you said the Chump effect policies take two forms. One is what I was describing, you know, conferring a benefit to a favored individual or group. The other is the failure to penalize irresponsible or illegal behavior. So let's give us an example of each, the bestowing a benefit, somebody that doesn't have to play by the rules or gets that insider deal.
Yeah, well, we're seeing this right now in the push to forgive a lot of college debt. You know, people who ran up a lot of debt, they didn't necessarily break a rule or a law or anything like that. But then you look at the other people who carefully saved their money for college or chose not to go to an expensive college. And those people get penalized, whereas the people who ran up the big debts get their debts forgiven. So you see an example of somebody getting something for nothing effectively, while other people don't, because they're in a group that's perceived as sympathetic.
Right.
You see the same thing sometimes when prosecutors or reformers, they're worried about sending too many people for prison or hurting people who might be from poor minority backgrounds. It's an understandable concern. But when you start effectively decriminalizing small crimes, as we've seen a lot of cities, New York, San Francisco, and others, you're creating an incentive for crime. And meanwhile, the majority of people in those neighborhoods who are law-abiding, they're the ones who suffer from the increase in crime in their neighborhoods.
Well, but the interesting thing, like on the college tuition for, and the debt forgiveness piece, since Biden is out promoting that at present, there's a second level to the scam, if you will, the second level to making chumps out of people. One is to say, well, we're going to confer this benefit on a sympathetic group. The second is that group turns out not to be sympathetic. So, for example, the college loan example, I should say, right? Three of every $4 in student debt is held by middle to upper middle income families or kids from those families. You're not helping the downtrodden. You're helping people who are part of your cadre, the ruling elite cadre.
And that's actually something that turns up a lot in these chump effect policies. They're often justified as an effort to help some group that seems very sympathetic. But over time, they create an incentive for that group to get bigger. People take advantage of the program, and they wind up benefiting people who are fairly affluent. You could look at farm subsidies as an example of that. You know, it started as a way to help farmers who were really struggling back in the Depression, but it's turned into this kind of mighty sluice of money that goes primarily to fairly large, fairly affluent farmers.
Yeah, like Sam Donaldson. Come back, I want to continue our discussion and inquire about another predatory government, another aspect of the nature of a predatory government. More with James Meigs, co-host of the How Do We Fix It podcast, former editor of Popular Mechanics. We'll be right back. Electric Avenue, and then we'll take it higher. We're gonna rock down to Electric. The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show. Welcome back. We're speaking with James Meigs, co-host of the How Do We Fix It podcast and the former editor of Popular Mechanics. He's written this compelling piece. It's City Journal called The Chump Effect, which we were talking about some of the aspects of how government policies turn Americans, significant percentages of the American population, into chumps. One other aspect I wanted to get your reaction to, James, is the predatory nature of government policies, government against the interests of the citizens. So the scams they run. So, one, you know, you mentioned conferring the benefit to a favored person or group. You mentioned not holding reckless or even illegal behavior accountable. There's this other aspect that's perhaps best exemplified by things like a cigarette tax or a red light camera. Please don't smoke cigarettes. We don't want you to smoke cigarettes. Cigarettes are bad for your health. That's why we're going to increase the taxes on it. Except we expect you to smoke cigarettes. We need you to smoke cigarettes because we've already budgeted for and spent the money we want to realize from your smoking of cigarettes. The same thing with red light cameras. Don't run red lights. You know, this is about traffic safety. Except please run red lights. We need you to run red lights. We need you to pile up those tickets because we've already budgeted for the amount of money we're going to get from the red light cameras for our municipal budget, and we're anticipating you doing this, and we need you to. So on the one hand, they promote these policies suggesting they're looking out for you. On the other hand, they're really just trying to get through your back pocket what they can't take from your front.
And so often the people who suffer from that kind of program are lower income people. You know, you see in some of these cash-strapped cities, they depend on all kinds of fines and penalties for a big chunk of their budget. And ordinary working people just trying to get through their day wind up really struggling sometimes when they get hit with these fines. It's really an unfair situation. I would also look at Lotto as being in
absolutely.
That category.
Yeah, regressive.
Exactly, yeah. exactly. And the people who really can't afford it are being encouraged, urged by government to gamble a little bit every day. And, you know, if you thought about those, somebody puts $5 a day on Lotto. Imagine if that money went into a 401k instead.
Yeah, it's always interesting to look at lottery ticket purchases by zip code. Like I look at that in my home state of Illinois. And it's funny, you find that, you know, in the wealthiest areas, not much in terms of Lotto ticket sales. And in the poorest areas, that's where the preponderance of, if not majority of Lotto ticket sales are made. To your point, it's just another way to run a scam on the poor while you're saying, we're going to fund education with Lotto. Okay, so you're going to fleece the poor to fund education and mainly schools that the poor don't even get access to.
You know, the great University of Chicago economist Milton Friedman used to say that if you look at government-run Lotto programs and compare them to the ones, the numbers of schemes run by the mob actually paid off much better
yes.
for the participants than the government-run programs.
Precisely. I don't want to overstate the case, but particularly in this era and after November 3rd, where you're getting into hard drug legalization in places like Oregon. I mean, the government really is in the old mob rackets. I mean, what they've done is they saw what they were doing in the black market economy, the underground economy. They said, man, we can make a lot of money here. So let's just legitimize them and we'll run them and we'll distribute the benefits to our friends. How really much different is that than what organized crime used to do?
You know, I don't have a problem with people choosing to play the Lotto or go to Vegas and gamble.
Right.
But I do have a problem with the government encouraging people to do it.
Spending tax dollars to advertise to them to play the Lotto, right?
Exactly. And, you know, they have some very sophisticated, very compelling advertising that is kind of normalized as something that used to be considered a reckless, counterproductive practice.
And so how do people get out of societies, localities, states, get out of these kleptocratic traps? You know, obviously you can have a real revolt against the political class, like I think you saw in 2016 with Trump's election and the whole, you know, drain the swamp mantra. But, it's tough, as I was saying before, that the reason kleptocracies exist is because they co-opt just enough of the people that they're cut in, and those that are cut out can either stay and pay or they can leave and try and find some place that's less kleptocratic where they can live legitimately and don't have to play the pay to play, don't have to live the pay to play.
Well, I think the simplest answer is just if you have a smaller government that regulates less and doesn't take such a big role in trying to redistribute society's resources, then you don't have as many opportunities for these kinds of chump effect policies to come into play. So, you know, that's the kind of classic conservative or libertarian argument that just leave people alone, let them look after their own affairs, which they know best. And every effort to try to help them, of course, we need basic support for the poor and other things. I'm not arguing for some kind of pure libertarian landscape, but you have to be careful. Once you start helping one group, you're subtly disadvantaging another group. And as I said, it's often not the poorest or most disadvantaged people who get the help. The help often winds up moving up the income scale to people who are more politically connected, have more clout, more power.
Yeah.
So insiders, like people who work for public employees unions and they manage to negotiate these fantastic pensions, they wind up benefiting, whereas people who work regular jobs don't get that benefit. They don't have that clout. They wind up paying for it in their taxes.
Yeah. How about people paying for others to buy $90,000 Tesla sports cars with the subsidies that Tesla gets because, you know, it's green energy? I mean, it's just as yet
right,
another example
right,
of
exactly.
reverse welfare.
You know, I'm in favor of some reasonable environmental policies, but you have to be careful how you set them up because often it's the blue-collar worker, it's the lower-income person who can't afford a Tesla. They're not going to get the benefit, and the benefits tend to flow to more affluent people. Meanwhile, they also often raise prices and limit job opportunities for lower-income people.
And I'll tell you what, I mean, your piece is important because one of the things that needs to be done on a continuous basis is just bring these examples to the fore because you never know which is going to click. For example, I mean, all of the taxes and fees and scams in Illinois, the biggest revolt in recent years that I've witnessed was over a soda tax increase in Cook County. That drew more heat and put more politicians in the crosshairs, you know, electorally than all of the other taxes and scams and everything in a state known for taxes and scams. So you just never know, which is why just keep telling the stories, keep explaining the policies, keep documenting the policies that try to make people chumps, as you did in your City Journal piece.
You know, sometimes this stuff is just very visceral. There's just this sense of unfairness. Like, I played by the rules. I did my part.
Yep.
I've tried to be responsible. Now somebody else is getting this special benefit. And so it often just takes a small spark to make people kind of wake up and say, wait a minute, this just isn't right. This isn't how society should run.
He is James Meggs, co-host of the How Do We Fix It podcast and the former editor of Popular Mechanics. I will tweet out his excellent piece at City Journal, The Chump Effect. Not the Trump Effect, The Chump Effect. James, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks.
On the watchtower.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the show, and just a bit of a parting thought for the week. As we continue on with the electoral challenges by the Trump campaign. I was talking to a friend of mine and whether or not Trump should give a concession speech if he is unsuccessful with these legal challenges. And we both sort of agreed, you know, I don't really care. I don't think he owes the nation anything. But I think it would be good in this sense. I think it would be good to leave where he started, which is to say, for all of those elites they have dominion over, to which they've destroyed, I have the message: you're what's wrong with the country. I don't need some phony baloney unity message on the way out. He should lay it straight to the people that he fought for and that fought for him. You are destroying K-12 education. You're destroying the academy. You're destroying the arts. You cowardly, rent-seeking corporate C-suite types. I'm going to continue in private life to advocate on behalf of people who play by the rules in this country and who get fleeced by a system they finance. This is the conversation we were just having with James Meggs. I think that whole chump effect that he was describing, we were talking about before the break, is right on the point. And this has been building for a long time. And by the way, the other part of the concession speech would be thank you to those people who understood what I was trying to do and who held me to account for doing what we could to drain the swamp, what we could to take on the established order, what we could to rebalance the power relationship between the federal government and the individual American citizen and American family. Something along those lines I think would be useful. And I was just thinking about the people who play by the rules and the draining the swamp and thinking about what Trump tried to do. And remember, you count me as a skeptic at the outset. When he rode down that escalator, I didn't think much of him. But it's all reminiscent, especially as we've seen this play out in so many fronts, of an op-ed I actually wrote for Human Events 12 years ago, 2008, this in advance of the Obama election. Not exactly enthralled with the McCain candidacy. And I suggested at the time I wanted to launch a people who play by the rules party. For example, when you hear that 1 in 9 home mortgages are in foreclosure, the political media establishment pay attention to the 1 in foreclosure and treat the other 8 as if they only exist as a source of spare parts to salvage the 1. The people who play by the rules party is for the 40% of income earners in the country who get, which gets all the way down to $55,000 a year, who pay 99.4% of all federal income taxes in the name of fairness. The 99.7% of U.S. employers with fewer than 500 employees that don't have lobbyists, don't get bailed out by their Wall Street friends in government when they make bad strategic decisions or worse. All these employers do, the true entrepreneurial sector, is create jobs and create wealth. It'd be interesting, even if he's not a guy that's always necessarily played by the rules, that being Trump, whether in a second term or in exile, if you will, down at Mar-a-Lago, that he pushed for the creation of or the continuation of this movement into some more formal organization. That would be interesting, too. Something we don't have to contemplate yet, but it's interesting to kick these things around as matters play themselves out over the next few weeks. And we'll be back on Monday to continue playing out those matters. Thanks for joining us this week. Please do so again Monday and have a great weekend in the interim.
This is the Dan Proft Show.